Hello, and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. Just a little quick note here that I've got some more movie reviews being posted and more to come as the summer season is rolling out here and whatnot. And also, if you haven't yet checked out my Sensibly Speaking podcast 2.0, then I encourage you to do so. It's going in a new format, new direction. And I think so far it's been getting some very positive feedback and comments and whatnot. So check it out. This week we had a really nice interview with a guy who ran for office, ran for Congress. So anyway, and more interviews coming in the future on that line. I've been pretty busy lately with a lot of video content going up, and I don't particularly plan on stopping. So anyway, new series also on academic apologists for Scientology. You know, people who are academics, never been in Scientology, but somehow feel like they are in a position to be experts and offer their expert opinions about it. And they get it wrong so often, at least the ones I'm talking about in this book review that I've been doing. So that's a new series that just started as well, so check that out. And now let's get on with your questions. J. Magin JHF. During my time in Scientology, I saw many high-level public on the top of the Bloody Bridge die of cancer or something like that. It gave me the idea that cause over life was just a fake promise. How did you justify or view those deaths as a Sea Org member when you were in? For those of you who don't know, when people progress through to the highest levels of Scientology's auditing or counseling, way past the Xenu story and up to the higher levels through OT7, they're supposed to achieve a state called cause over life, which sounds pretty amazing and pretty wild, and is one of the ultimate goals of Scientology, is to be in a position where you are able to affect life, you know, your life, the life around you. Hubbard defines cause as, you know, being able to be at the source point of something, or being able to control things, you know, being able to start, change, stop them, things like that. And so cause over life is a pretty special place to be, and if only Scientology really offered that. So when people in Scientology who had achieved these high levels, surprise, still got cancer, still got sick, still had problems, still had cheated on their spouses, still got into car accidents, you know, this sort of thing, still wore glasses, all the things that you would, you know, if you were cause over life, what would you do? What could you do? What would you be expected to be able to do? What would you think, you know, you'd be able to do? I mean, kind of a lot of things, right? You know, certainly not get cancer, certainly not get sick, certainly not have to deal with, you know, problems with your eyes. But when you're in Scientology and you see people who have, you know, supposedly achieved these states, and yet they still have this kind of thing going on, the cognitive dissonance, bzzz, you know, so blah, 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 starts rattling around in your head. And you have to come up with some reason why this person would have had that bad thing happen to them, or have still have a bad chronic physical condition or something like that. And the way this would generally work would be, generally speaking, there were lots of reasons that people could come up with. But it generally came down to two reasons, okay? One of them has to do with, and both of them are basically on the person. It's a blame the victim sort of approach. It's not Scientology's fault, ever, that the person didn't achieve that state or is not showing that they've achieved that state. It's on the person. And the reason why is either one, the person is what we would call out ethics, or PTS, a potential trouble source, meaning they have come in contact with or had restimulated an earlier contact with a suppressive person, okay? There's some bad guy in their life, some suppressive person or SP, who is, you know, suppressing them, is on them. And the only reason in Scientology that you can become PTS or a potential trouble source, you know, in other words, an SP comes along and you, you know, go to the effect of them, it's called, or go under their power or somehow are influenced by them. The only reason that can happen is because you yourself have gone out ethics, okay? Now, going out ethics means you're doing something wrong in your life. You're committing overts. You're committing bad deeds, right? Overts are bad deeds. All this Scientology terminology that I'm having to dredge up here. Basically, it's your fault, okay? And it's your fault because you are, you know, stealing from the cookie jar. You're cheating on your wife. You're doing something that you shouldn't be doing. Maybe it's not even something extreme. Maybe it's just something you're not doing as good a job at work as you know you should be, or you're slacking off when you should be working for Scientology. That can be out ethics, right? You're not giving all the money that you should be giving to Scientology. Believe me, that could definitely be considered out ethics in Scientology. But whatever the thing is, when I or other Sea Org members or other Scientologists would look at an OT in Scientology and see that they had some non-optimum situation going on, we could think to ourselves, oh, well, they must, especially if they die of cancer or something, or gets chronically ill or something like that. We just shrug it off. We just go, oh, they're just PTS. They're out ethics. And it's that labeling thing. You throw a label on it, and then you don't have to think about it anymore. Oh, it's their fault. See, it's their responsibility. So there's that reason, okay? The other reason is what's all the fashion in Scientology and has been for quite a few years now, is that their earlier steps, okay, if this is OT, if this is the high level here, then the earlier steps they did before, something got missed. Something was wrong. Something didn't get done the way it was supposed to. And Miscavige has been throwing this out as the saving grace for all these OTs who aren't really OT. Is he says, oh, well, there's a very easy explanation for that. You didn't achieve the full gains of the earlier levels that you did and you thought you'd finished. And we said you'd finished it. But, you know, we found this other stuff and it turns out, yeah, it wasn't written right. It's somebody messed it up, some whatever. Whatever the bullshit explanation that Miscavige gives as to why these earlier levels were not completed to full end result, it gives the OTs and everybody in Scientology a reasonable, to them, justification for why OTs aren't really OT, why they don't act OT, why they don't look OT, why they have problems, why they die of cancer, why they commit suicide, why all these horrible, awful things happen to OTs that shouldn't happen because they're supposed to be these superhuman people. And Scientologists just suck this stuff up, and I did too, you know, back when I was in Scientology, because here's the thing. Scientologists desperately want Scientology to be true. And the more you do Scientology, the longer you're in it, the more invested you are in that. And the more you need it to be true. And the harder the fall is when you find out it's not. So people resist that fall. They resist finding that out. And our minds work in such a way that it's easy for us to continue to justify things that don't really make any damn sense. And I've talked about that at length. It's called confirmation bias. And we all do it. All of us do it in all parts of our lives. But Scientologists are very, very good at doing it with Scientology and with L. Ron Hubbard and whatever David Miscavige says, which is one reason why David Miscavige is continuing to be in power in Scientology is because he puts on a good show and he gives very reasonable sounding explanations to Scientologists. It sounds reasonable to them. It doesn't sound reasonable to us when you're outside of Scientology, but when you're in the bubble world, his speeches sound awesome. and you want to believe so badly that you'll take anything. They're grasping at straws. And at this point, you know, it really is grasping at straws. So that's how we did that. Scott Durham. So much of the punishment that goes on at Intbase is classified as voluntary. I have heard you say that most of the people in the RPF are convinced they need the fixing that they can get only in an RPF setting. This visually makes me believe that Scientology is very good at breaking a human being down into a humiliated mass of guilt. I wonder if you could take us through the specific activities and psychological tropes that a new believer might experience in trying to achieve the respective disciplines of a pre-clear, clear OT. I heard about the ashtray thing and the staring at each other routine, but there has got to be some kind of magic bullet they're using to keep people on track. I simply cannot believe that the message is that convincing on its own. There have got to be little blackmails and some extortion going on. In some cases, would the use of actual physical restraint be employed to keep someone at an org or public Scientology space? Do these restraint techniques intensify as we get closer to the gold base? Is there a hierarchy of abuse capacity respective to the increased atmosphere of Hubbardness? I guess what I mean is this. Are the Scientologists more insane as we get closer to the Scientology sun? How much time did you yourself spend in the dreaded hole? Okay, well, here I'm actually writing a whole book about the RPF and human rights abuses in Scientology. And so I can't really address this entire question in a couple minutes answer in my Q&A videos here. So I'm just going to throw some things out at you and do with this what you will. But you're asking for a lot here. First off, I did not spend any time in the hole, and this is a common misconception. The RPF, the Rehabilitation Project Force, is not the hole. The hole was something that was set up at the INT base for international executives and staff of the INT base that had fallen into disfavor with David Miscavige, and it was a form of, a Chinese re-education and torture camp is really what the hole was. And that really is not the RPF. Although I've called the RPF a form of a re-education camp, and it is, the whole is actually worse because of the way it's set up and stuff. They're not auditing each other in the whole. There's no program of steps that they're going to get through where at the end of it, they know they're going to be released and they're done. And the RPF gives you that. It gives you, while it's pretty crazy and there's a lot of nonsense that goes on with it, at least you have a step-by-step program of things to do. And when you're done, you're done. And then you're finished. And then they let you out. You know, you've done your time. And with the whole, it's not like that. It is 100% David Miscavige's whim. And he's had people in there for years, as I understand it, many, many years. And they are... they're in there declared suppressive persons. They're declared SPs, which is the worst thing that can happen to you in Scientology is to be declared a suppressive person. So here they are in the hole, declared suppressive people, and it's only by the good graces of David Miscavige that they're allowed to continue in Scientology at all, that they're allowed to keep their jobs, that they're allowed to continue to be in the C organization. And it's only by his good graces that they're not, sent to the far end of the earth to go flip burgers at McDonald's. I mean, this is how they're talked to, right? This is what they think is, that they're being given this chance. And so they, grasp at those straws and keep going. So that's the whole different from the RPF. There are other differences too. Schedule's different, what they do is different. But that's, I just wanted to clarify that, right? So I was never at the international base. Never stepped foot there, and I have never been in the hole. So I just wanted to address that part first because it's a very common misconception. As far as the tactics that are used to get people to fall for and agree to the Scientology mindset, it's a gradual process of agreements. It's a very slow process before you get a person to the state of mind that they'll endure something like the RPF or the whole. You don't get there overnight. Nobody does, right? it's a very gradual series of things. And it's also individual for different people, because different people come into Scientology for different reasons. They want different things out of it. And with Scientology salesmen, one size fits all. Like, no matter what you come in saying you want, they'll tell you that this course will solve it, or this, or Scientology definitely has the answer to whatever your problem is. So, but from the individual's point of view, their unique situation and circumstance is not the same as you know, Mary Sue's and Joe's and Bill's and Sally's, right? So from the way they see it and the way they're talked to and their own experience is unique to them. So they might take different parts of Scientology or have different parts given to them, and that's the way that they agree that it's true or real. Some people, for example, might come in and do that communications course, and that's very wonderful for them. And now they've agreed that Scientology works. That's the first thing you have to get the person to agree to. Another person might come in and the communications course isn't his thing, but getting rid of drugs or something is, and so he does that purification rundown and he sweats, you know, 5 hours a day, and he feels physically better as a result of that, if he doesn't kill him, and he and he thinks that's why Scientology works, is because it sweated out all those toxins that were lodged in his fatty tissues, even though no toxins are lodged in your fatty tissues. Anyway, certainly not LSD. So he's convinced of this, and so he thinks Scientology works. And if that's the first thing you have to get, is Scientology works. And once the person has really accepted that is true, then all of Hubbard's promises and all the things that Scientologists and staff around him are telling him about Scientology take on a new, it's a new level of acceptance of all of that stuff. Whereas when he was out on the street, not having come into Scientology, if they had told him that he could attain the state of clear and never have to, you know, have thoughts and voices rattling around in his head anymore, he could just clearly think without, you know, in concepts, without having to use words and things like that. This is the sort of things I heard over the years. If somebody told him that, well, on the first day, he might be really skeptical of that. He might be like, come on, dude, you're talking nonsense. But after he's accepted that Scientology works, now the possibility of that being true is amped up, and he's more willing to accept something like that, right? And he continues to do Scientology, and he gets these little gains, because most of the gains of Scientology are at the lowest levels, because that's where they really need to get you to a point where you're going to keep going. And the only reason anybody keeps going in Scientology is because they've gotten some kind of gains out of it. They've experienced some kind of subjective personal win or gain, and they want more of that. And the more of that they get, the more sure they are it works, and the more willing they are to put up with the increasing amount of restrictive thought control and action control that occurs on Scientologists, where, for example, you ask about, you know, are they physically restrained? Well, no, nobody's tying up Scientologists, right? That, I've never seen that. But they do get to a point where in the C organization, for example, or some staff members will get to the point where they will buy into the idea of what's called an interiorization rundown. Or sorry, not an interiorization rundown, introspection rundown, where somebody goes a little wacko and they have to be kept under watch, right? And somebody has to watch them, and they watch them by keeping them in a room, right? And they'll think, because Scientology works and Hubbard said this is what you're supposed to do, that this is the way to handle this person who's gone woohoo, right? Doesn't happen a lot, very, very rarely. I can count on one hand how many times I saw this happen in the 27 years that I was in Scientology. It's not like everybody in Scientology is going crazy. But when it happens and somebody is restrained, right, then, restrained in a room and kept under watch 24 hours a day for their own good, right, this is how the Scientologists will get to a state of mind where they think that that's a good thing and that that's what they should be doing, right? So that's a very, very short version of the process. It's a gradual series of agreements, each agreement bringing you deeper and deeper and deeper into the Scientology world. And so when you refer in your question to a magic bullet, no, there isn't a single thing that happens or a single point of agreement that happens where suddenly the person flips and it's black and white. It doesn't work like that. It's a shades of gray thing, and they just go from, you know, darker and darker and darker and darker as they get deeper and deeper and deeper in. And yes, the higher you go, the crazier it can get. But that's not to say that I think that the higher you go, the crazier you become. And I want to be clear about that, because I'm not calling Scientologists crazy. I don't think that's what they are. I think that there are things that are done that are mental manipulation techniques and thought control techniques that Scientologists experience, and that can cause psychological damage and emotional damage in some Scientologists. And so, you know, when they come out of that, then, you know, they can have some issues and some stuff to deal with. That can happen, right? Because of the nature of how Scientology works on people, how it does its thing. So, but I don't want that misinterpreted to mean that I'm saying Scientologists are crazy or that I think everybody who comes out of Scientology is crazy, because that's not what I said and never what I meant. Tro125. Hi, Chris. I live two blocks from a Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall, and not surprisingly, there are a lot of proselytizers in my neighborhood. I can't always avoid them. Today, I mentioned to one that I did not support their practice of shunning, and he argued that they only shun people for very valid reasons, like adultery. How do you handle folks like Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormon missionaries? I rarely see Scientologists unless I happen to be walking directly past the ideal org. I want to be polite, but some of them have a hard time taking no for an answer. We're obviously not going to change each other's minds. Okay, some advice I can give on this is to Google or look up Anthony Magnabosco's Street Epistemology. It's fascinating stuff, and what it is it's a method of talking to people who are, you know, believers or whatever, and asking them just very sharp and pointed and direct logical questions, with the design in mind of not arguing, not debating, not getting into some big, you know, philosophical debate about their belief system or whatnot, but instead the purpose of it is to get them thinking. Because what you're dealing with Jehovah's Witnesses or Scientologists or any of these folks is that they're not thinking, they're parroting. They're repeating things that they've been told or have read, and they have not given a lot of critical thought or analysis to what they're saying. If they did, then it would quickly break down because it's not really very logical and it doesn't make a lot of sense. But they think that it does because they're not thinking about it. So the tactic you want to use is get them thinking, not get them arguing or get them parroting to you, okay? Now that's if you want to take the time to do it at all. The other thing, of course, is you just ignore them and smile and move on, you know, because they're playing a numbers game. So you don't have to worry about hurting their feelings or, you know, offending them or something. That's the last thing you should be worried about with somebody from the JWs or Scientology or Westboro Baptists or something like that. They're hardly there. So you don't have to really worry about being impolite or something, which is not to say that you need to be rude, but my point is that, you know, if you just say, look, no, I'm not interested and I don't want to talk to you, and just go talk to somebody else, they shrug and they move on because they know that they're playing a numbers game. You know, they're not going to get everybody. And if they, you know, are so deluded that they think they are, well, that's definitely somebody you don't want to be talking to. Okay. Mark Lacasse 1. Hi, Chris. I'm reading your book, and it's very interesting. If someone had the possibility to write an email to a Sea Org member recently in, would it be a good idea? If so, what would the good things to write about to wake him, her up? Okay, when somebody's in the C organization, they are in a very controlled environment. They are monitored 24/7. Their schedule is controlled 24/7. Unless they happen to get a leave or some time off to go visit family or something, you have to understand that when you're writing to a person like that, especially with like an email or a short phone call, there is nothing you're going to say to them that's going to wake them up, that's going to snap them out of it. Doesn't work that way. Never works that way. Never heard of a case of somebody saying magic words to somebody and they go, oh, wow, what am I doing here? And they stand up and walk out. Doesn't happen, okay? So you need to bring the expectation level down. When you're dealing with a Sea Org member, especially, if you're going to write an email to them with the intention of getting them eventually to wake up or to start seeing that something's wrong, that's not going to happen really in an email. I mean, I'm not saying it can't ever happen, but you got to just realize what you're talking to, okay? So my general advice for people, anybody out there who isn't fully educated on cults, destructive cults, what makes up destructive cults, who isn't fully educated on the mind control techniques that Scientology uses, and isn't fully educated on the lifestyle and what goes on a daily basis for somebody who's in the C organization, if you don't really have a good grip on all of that, then, which most people don't, then my advice is don't get into it. Instead, maintain communication with that person by talking to them about things that they can easily, comfortably talk about and will want to continue talking to you about them. Like, for example, if the person's really into movies, then write them an email and tell them how you're doing, ask how they're doing, and talk about movies. Keep it, and, you know, I'm talking about non-Scientology related stuff. Keep it anchored in the real world, but keep it also anchored in things that you know this person will not become alarmed by you saying to them. And if you start saying things to a Sea Org member like, you know, I read this, you know, article about Scientology, or boy, that David Miscavige really doesn't seem like he's got his head on straight, or you start going anywhere near that, they're going to hit the eject button. You're going to become somebody that they're going to have a hard time justifying continuing to talk to. And they're going to find it very easy to not talk to you anymore because they got other Sea Org members to talk to. Right? And that's how that rolls. So you don't want to do that. You do not want to give them a reason to alienate or to feel alienated from you. So keep it real, but keep it light, and keep it so that they're going to want to write you back. And then you're going to write them back, and you're going to be able to maintain a communication with them, right? That's not hostile or antagonistic in any way to Scientology. That's my best advice. Because then, if and when, at some point in the future, they do start experiencing doubts or problems or something's not right in their world, they might be willing to tell you about it. Whereas if you antagonize them, or rather antagonize Scientology, or say there's something wrong with it, they're going to put the shields up, and then they're not going to be willing to talk to you anymore. Or they're going to only restrict what they're going to talk to you about because they're going to feel that you're somebody who's not what they would call a safe terminal. You know, somebody they can actually be open with and share things with. It's a miracle if you can actually maintain a good, friendly communication with somebody who's in the Sea Org for any length of time. Because that world is a very closed world. And it's not a world by its nature, it's not open to outside communications and outside interference. And it's very guarded against those things. So that's my best advice. Ben, many of your Q&A submissions are about the hypothetical downfall of mini-me COB and the collapse of the Church of Scientology. My question is not about the how or when, but rather about the aftermath of the end. Some context. In the 1840s, self-proclaimed prophet William Miller read his Bible, predicted the end of the world, and gathered together a doomsday cult of believers, many of whom sold all of their earthly belongings. But like every prophet before and after, Miller was wrong and the world kept spinning, so his cult followers scattered. The interesting tidbit, modern researchers have discovered that a sizable percentage of his disappointed followers ended up in mental hospitals. So, when the end arrives, do you think that diehard Scientology loyalists will be able to adjust to the WOG world? Or will a number of them end up in mental hospitals or under close psychiatric care? Yeah, I think they'll be able to adapt just fine. I mean, I have, and lots and lots and lots of other former Scientologists have adapted to the real world and not ended up in the, you know, in the spin bin or anything. It's not like that, you know. People in Scientology are able to get along with other people for the most part pretty well, and coming back into the real world is definitely an adjustment. No question about it. And for some, more than others, like I've said before, there can be, you know, a pretty intense recovery process from it, depending on how deeply involved they were, how long they were involved with it, how deeply, you know, what kind of things happened to them while they were in Scientology, what kind of abuses and that sort of thing. Because there is physical abuse, there is mental abuse, there is emotional abuse. And they're, you know, and it's good to get some help from that when that's necessary or when that's needed. But, you know, as far as being concerned about, you know, former Scientologists needing, you know, that the majority of them are going to end up in a mental hospital, no way. That's just, that doesn't pan out from what's already happened in the real world, you know. I think the figure is either 5 or 10 times the number of people who have ever been in the Sea Org are now out of the Sea Org. And, you know, and I know a lot of these people, and they adjusted just fine. They had a lot of work to do to do that adjustment in terms of getting grounded, getting jobs, you know, getting job skills, and then overcoming whatever, you know, stuff they had to overcome if they did. But that's about it, you know. I think it's a false equivalency, because Scientology is not a doomsday cult. And to equate the two, I don't think that's a good comparison. Scientologists don't think the end of the world is coming tomorrow. And the kind of person who would get into the mindset where they think that literally everything is ending and they are going to experience the rapture and go live with, you know, God or Jesus in heaven, and, you know, that's a whole different mindset than a Scientologist who's dedicated and working hard to try to improve themselves, and in many cases try to improve other people, because they think that the world's pretty screwed, but they don't think it's ending tomorrow. You know, very, very, very few Scientologists get into that kind of extreme mindset. So, and it's flash answers time. Hamish Downey. I'm very curious how ex-Sea Org members who leave the church are able to handle the debt. It seems as if the Church of Scientology charges people who have left the Sea Org quite a bit of money. Yet, it seems that those members have also been working for next to no money for years. Is there a network of people who are able to retrain and support them back into the workforce? No, there's no network. And if there was, OSA or the Church of Scientology would do everything they could to disband it. You know, there are individual former Scientologists who help people who come out of Scientology do various things to assist people as they can and that sort of thing. But there isn't some underground railroad or something like that. And as far as how they handle the debt, well, if they want to continue doing Scientology, they have to pay what's called a freeloader's debt, which is the, you know, for money that that they now owe the church because they did services when they were under contract. Very few people who come out of Scientology pay that freeloader's debt and continue doing Scientology. Most of them get out and they go, South Park, internet, Going Clear, oh my God. And they like, Jesus, and they hit the eject button and they never look back. So that's pretty much how it goes. George Boslaw. What do all the doodads, military term, right, on DM's uniform signify? Well, all those campaign ribbons are what they're called, or campaign bars, signify either courses or, you know, classes that people have done, training levels that they've done, or it signifies projects or missions that they did or were involved with. And I could do an entire video on all the different ones, but it doesn't matter. You hardly ever see them. And real fast, there is a special one that Chairman of the Board, David Miscavige, wears, and it's usually the only one he wears when he goes out and does his public stuff, because if he wore all the ones he had, they'd, you know, be gigantic. But he's got a very special one that he likes to show off, which indicates that he speaks for L. Ron Hubbard. It's like two or three people have these things, and he's the only one who actually, you know, uses it. And it's supposedly was awarded by Hubbard. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what it signifies, is that anything he says, yeah, it's as good as from L. Ron Hubbard. Leo Taxel, you say that many orgs have had problems paying their rent. So are the ideal orgs actually pointless? If they own them, wouldn't that mean they provide a rent-free, tax-free solution in the long run? Yeah, these aren't actually contrary things. The orgs that have trouble paying their rent are the non-ideal orgs who are still renting their facilities or leasing or, you know, don't own their building. This is one of the reasons for the ideal org program, is that it puts the org in a position where it can own its own building and not have to pay rent anymore. And so we come to the end of another edition of Critical Q&A. Thank you very much for coming around. If you have any questions, comments, feedback, leave it in the comment section below, and I will get to it and put in my question queue. And if, again, you find this educational, informative, and interesting, consider throwing some love and support my way, either using the donate button on my homepage or becoming part of my Patreon campaign, which is just wonderful. The folks who throw me support that way really are the ones who enable me to do this work. This channel is entirely fan-funded, and everything I do because you guys are enabling me to do it. All my little enablers out there. So thank you very much, all of you, and thanks for watching, and I'll see you next week.